Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. A shocker. Just months into her latest term, Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles announces her resignation. Meanwhile, it's budget time at the city, with the city manager pushing for a property tax increase, even as the General Assembly calls for a pause on revaluations and a cap on property taxes.
We have seen an extensive increase in property values.
The Atrium Health merger with Wake Med hits a roadblock. Data centers in Charlotte may hit one too. And the transition to a new regional transit authority slows down.
There was no way they were going to meet that deadline. Yeah, it was unrealistic from the start.
Plus, the PGA's second biggest event of the season tees off at Quail Hollow. And we hear about those stories and more from WFAE Politics reporter Steve Harrison, Ashley Fays, managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Joe Bruno is here, a reporter for WSOC-TV, and Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte. We are all in the same room at the same time, and they said it would never happen. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Wow. In a surprise development yesterday morning, you know who's not here today?
Who?
The mayor. In a surprise move yesterday morning, Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles announced that she would be resigning effective June the 30th. This came as a surprise to a lot of people, maybe not to those of you in this room. Steve, I know you've been reporting that there have been questions on and off council about whether she would complete her term. When did those questions start being raised?
Yeah, I think all of us here at the table, reporters, I think we started getting more calls from people in the community in the last 6 months or so about just the mayor's energy level, her ability to do the job, just things like that. I think we started hearing that, and it picked up a bit. And the mayor is 73. She's done this job. This is her fifth term. Yeah. And I think people started reaching out and just kind of asking if the mayor was still up for this. And I think that there was a sense inside the government center that she probably was not going to finish the full term.
We talked about this before we went on the air, and Joe, you mentioned that perhaps she ran for re-election because she wanted to see the transit tax over the finish line. And once that's done, her job is done, maybe?
That's why she told me she ran, is because of the transit tax. She wanted to see it through. It was in many ways her baby. I mean, she pushed for it for 5 years. She got it on the ballot. She campaigned for it in a lighter way, but she was seen as the face of it. It passed, and now she's passing the torch.
And you spoke with her on Monday, I believe, Steve, and we talked about this the other day, the morning after she resigned. She declined to answer the question, will you be completing your term? And she just said, we will see. And then she was escorted away by a top aide and by a CMPD officer. Is that out of the ordinary?
Yeah, I think so. So the way it works at city council is there's the formal chamber where the meetings happen, and then there's a lot of other meetings in this conference room upstairs that's very informal, and it's very easy for reporters to talk to anyone, elected officials, staff. And so it's a great place to get information. And so I approached the mayor there, which is really common. It's not out of the ordinary, but they were being very protective and just, we are not going to do this interview. We're not going to talk about this. You are not going to talk to her. And I think probably that did precipitate Thursday's announcement. Like I said before, I think this was probably coming some point this summer, perhaps. But I think it did kind of speed up the clock a little bit.
And you mentioned that there have been discussions among members of council behind the scenes about whether or not she would complete her term, and you also mentioned in a series of articles that you've written and reported about this, that she's been turning over control of a lot of meetings that the mayor would normally be part of to other people like Ed Driggs. She hasn't been to a zoning meeting in quite a while.
Yeah.
That's unusual?
So the city's charter does say that the mayor shall preside over all meetings, and that includes city council zoning meetings. Now, zoning, these monthly zoning meetings don't have these glamorous issues, you know, that like that in a way, they're very important, right? We build new townhomes and gas stations. They're very important to a small segment of the population, but they are hard. They are tedious. They last a long time. And the mayor, just for the past year, has just hasn't gone. Just doesn't go.
There have also been reports that at times the mayor has seemed confused or out of sorts, or I'm not sure what words to use here, but not her normal self. Is that speculation? Is that amplified by this decision that maybe doesn't really exist, but there were little signs that we saw and now it makes sense? I mean, there's a lot of speculation going on here. Should we be speculating, I guess, is a good question.
I think it's fair to say that, you know, the mayor has aged, and the responses that she would give to certain questions maybe 5 or 6 years ago are not the same as she would give today. And yes, there have been times where she has stumbled or appeared confused in meetings or gave a long, winding answer. However, I don't think we were at the point where there was legitimate concern about the mayor's well-being and able to at least do the job that the mayor's position is in Charlotte. Because remember, it's a weak mayor system. She's not running the day-to-day of Charlotte. That goes to the city manager. But certainly, I do think over time, the mayor's firepower, and particularly over the last 6 months or so, has diminished. And part of that is age.
Yeah, I think that Steve's story yesterday morning before the mayor's announcement was kind of something that we were all waiting on. It was kind of like, who's going to be the first one to say something about the fact that the mayor has seemed less herself, has been less kind of quick with her words. It's been hard to quote her on certain positions lately. But at the same time, it hasn't seemed like it's been an issue for getting city business done. So it's like, at what point, as a reporter, is it's right or responsible or ethical for you to start calling out that the mayor is, it seems like she could reach a point where she's not going to fulfill the job at the correct capacity.
She served for 9 years as mayor. That's a long time. She's the second longest serving mayor other than Pat McCrory in Charlotte history. And she spent prior to that more than 30 years as a member of city government and on city council. I think she was the assistant city manager for a while. I would imagine that gave her, that position as assistant city manager, gave her a pretty keen insight into how to deal with city workers and with city management as a member of council and as the mayor. That's good. Would that be difficult to replace? It seems to me it might be.
Yeah, I think so. She has institutional knowledge. I think there will be buildings or light rail stops are both named after her one day. I think that she has accomplished more than many other mayors. She's the 59th mayor in Charlotte's history, one of the most impactful when you think of hundreds of millions for affordable housing, a generational transit package that was passed in large part because of her leadership. I think she is she's had a wonderful career for the city of Charlotte. And I also think because of the way she is going out by setting a resignation date kind of before things get too bad, it preserves a lot of her legacy.
You mentioned things being named after her, and I believe that Pat McCrory, when asked about her legacy, said that he thought that the City Hall might be named after her. Is that a possibility?
Maybe. I think the county technically owns the building, so she might have to fight Dina DiIorio for that honor or something. But
so we've had a few other mayors who have resigned prior to their term being up. Patrick Cannon resigned in a scandal. Anthony Fox, I think, resigned to go to the Obama administration as, was it transportation secretary, I think. How have we filled these premature vacancies in the past?
So for Anthony Fox's vacancy, they appointed Patsy Kinsey, who was a current city council member at the time. But I don't think back then she had many higher office ambitions. And then in 2014, when Patrick Cannon resigned, they appointed Dan Clodfelter, who ended up running for mayor after that appointment. So it is council's decision. The state law says it has to be a Democrat since that's Vi Lyles' party, but it doesn't say like it has to be a council member. They can appoint anyone from the Democratic Party that they want. So they could tap into the General Assembly. They could look for a business leader. They could look for someone with council experience. And we'll see what they do. I mean, for other vacancies, they've opened up an application. I don't know if that necessarily makes sense for the mayoral position, but those talks are happening.
Does the council make the decision?
Council will choose.
Yeah, I was going to add that. I just think it's interesting. I haven't gone back and studied it, and you guys might know better than I do because you guys have been around longer. But the fact that we had kind of back-to-back or very close together one situation where we had an insider come in and then one situation where we had an outsider come in, and to maybe look at those two situations and see which one went better or smoother, and should we be following the lead of one interim mayor pick over the other?
When Edwin Peacock, filled the vacated seat of Tariq Bakari, who left council to go to the Trump administration for a brief period, they made a point of asking him if he was going to run for that seat, and he said no. He went later, I think, ended up running for a different seat, an at-large seat. Are they going to ask that question of whoever takes this position if they're going to run for
probably
mayor in 2027? Why does it matter?
Well, because a lot of them want to be mayor. And why would they vote for somebody who's going to have a leg up as an incumbent and be able to talk about all these accomplishments?
So that means it won't be somebody from council.
I would be surprised if it was somebody from council unless they swore in blood that they weren't running for mayor, or somebody who absolutely has no higher office ambition. I mean, I think that this could be a good springboard job for somebody. If you're in the General Assembly, like, you can be mayor for 18 months and then run for, a congressional seat or for a statewide seat in 2028. Like, there, you have options.
It's better to be mayor of Charlotte, who has only breaks ties when there's a tie on the board, than it is to be a member of the General Assembly.
I think it is.
Yeah,
Steve and I talk about this all the time. Like, a city council in Charlotte is like, you're on TV every day, you're covered every day, like. General Assembly, you know, when you're from Mecklenburg County, you're not as in the loop or covered.
You're just an interchangeable Democrat.
Right.
I mean, and so there's 13 House members. The number of people in this county who could list all 13 members of the Mecklenburg State House delegation, 100? I mean, it's just so weird. Joe's right. City council has a much higher profile than the state legislature.
Alex?
Well, I'm just interested to see if whoever becomes mayor next is somebody who really wants to take strong positions on things like 77 and data centers, because Mayor Lyles has kind of been the moderate and the middle point on all of this. And she hasn't really taken stark positions on those. So I think that's something that we don't want to undersell, is that whoever is in that position can really lead the conversation and has a lot of power in that sense.
Yeah, to Alex's point, someone I spoke to yesterday said council really needs a steady hand on the till right now. With all of these big issues kind of coming up, the mayor's resignation coming around all of these things, whether it's 77 or data centers or the budget, there's just been a lot of division on council and even within the Democrats on council. So to Alex's point, the mayor has kind of maybe been the broker in between those and the sort of moderate. But whoever they pick, I think that could be contentious, because some folks might want to see someone who will align more with their philosophy, whereas the other side of council might prefer someone a little bit more moderate. So I think that's going to set up an interesting debate.
And she says she will not endorse any candidate who might replace her on this interim basis, and made a point of saying that the city will be in good hands with Marcus Jones. What does that say about the position of mayor?
Good point.
Emphasis on weak mayor.
Yes.
I mean, Mayor Lyles, we're going to need your help, because this could get really messy. You might need to make an endorsement at some point or give them some guidance.
A wink and a nod.
Well, city council's working on Charlotte's budget. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about property taxes, potential going up or being capped or both in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter, Ashley Fayes, managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger, Joe Bruno reports for WSOC-TV, Channel 9, and Alexandra Sands is here, a reporter for Axios Charlotte. It's budget time in the city, and Charlotte City Manager Marcus Jones has proposed a nearly 7% increase in property taxes for the fiscal year, which begins in July. That sounds steep, is it?
It's 1.89 cents for a house that is $360,000, which is described as the average home in Charlotte.
How much?
$360,000? It sounds low to me.
That sounds low.
But for the person with a $360,000 home, it's about $5.70 extra a month.
But 7%, is that the average tax increase when we look at tax increases?
If we want to get, so we're talking about property tax levy limits in the General Assembly, and figures have been tossed out like 3% or 4% or 5%. And under that context, like if a levy limit was in place, it's possible the city wouldn't be able to raise the tax as high as it is right now. So 7%, I guess, is a little higher than maybe what the General Assembly would like to see.
And how will they be using this money?
The budget presentation that the manager did said it's all going to go to public safety, I mean, which has been a big concern. I mean, and I think a big concern in the community and on the council. And so I think the main thing is most, Joe, you will probably know maybe a little more details. Most officers and CMPD will get a 10% raise,
yeah,
which is very significant. They feel like that's going to help them retain officers, fill vacancies. So that is kind of the main driver of the tax increase.
Ashley.
It also includes raises for Charlotte Fire. This has been brought up a lot, the wages for Charlotte Fire. So I think it's a 7% on average raise for folks up to the captain level for Charlotte Fire.
Yeah, 10% for police officers, 7% for firefighters. And if you're wondering about why the difference, City Manager Marcus Jones explained it this way.
So we have a problem with attracting and retaining police officers. We don't have the same problem with attracting and retaining firefighters.
Okay, so I can't remember the last time I got a 10% raise. So how does that compare with the private sector? And is it because police officer salaries and firefighter salaries are way below the private sector already?
Well, I think the rest of the city employees, non-police and fire, are getting 4% or so. So that's a comparison right there. They have 186 vacancies at CMPD, and that number is in flux because of recruitment classes and stuff, but 186 as of May 1st. They have 60-something Charlotte Fire vacancies, and police recruitment is incredibly competitive when you have like Huntersville trying to up Charlotte Mecklenburg Police on salary and the Sheriff's Office launching a big drive to get deputies in their doors. So there's inherent competition to recruit police officers, and I think that is one of the main reasons why that they are throwing a 10% raise to them. And also, they want to send a message that public safety is important. It was a really challenging year last year. Charlotte was the poster city, either fairly or unfairly, as a city of violent crime. And this is one of the ways the city is trying to address that perception.
This also marks the first time, I believe, that the city budget has surpassed $1 billion, and it represents a 10.5% increase from the previous year. How much of that is due to these raises versus the increased cost of everything?
I think the property tax increase will bring in $89 million, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's going to be some natural growth in the budget just because we have people moving here, new homes, new businesses, et cetera. But the new revenue is pretty significant. Now, to be fair to the city manager has not raised the property tax rate. I think this is the second
in seven years. Yeah.
To be fair. Now, the one thing that I kind of notice on my tax bill, the tax bill comes with our property tax and our solid waste fee. I mean, it's really the same thing, you know, right. But a fee is technically not a tax. The fee used to be $39 back in 2017. Now it's going to be, I think, $160-something.
Yes.
You know.
And that comes on your Charlotte water bill. And I got to tell you, when the water bill comes in, and I don't use a lot of water, it's shocking to me.
So the garbage fee is separate, but that's the stormwater fee. Okay, but Mike, right on both.
But all these fees are going up.
Yeah, everything.
They always do.
It is very high.
So this is coming at the same time that sales taxes on everything we buy are set to go up by 1 cent for the transit tax that we all said, well, we didn't all say yes to it, but voters said yes to it in November. Is the county also contemplating a property tax increase?
May 11th is when they present that. I think a property tax increase is on the table there as well.
Okay. Meanwhile, in Raleigh, the General Assembly is taking its own position on property taxes. This week, the North Carolina Senate okayed a property tax revaluation pause. That is not the same thing as taxes, but it's connected to taxes, and it's being driven by concerns over rapidly rising real estate values. Senator Steve Jarvis is a Republican representing Davidson County, where he says property tax values or property values have risen 60%.
We have seen an extensive increase in property values, something in the double digits that we've never seen in the history. With this moratorium, it will also provide the legislature time to actually address property tax values and what we may want to do in the future.
So what would this proposed moratorium on revaluations do?
It pauses or does not allow nine or so counties to use the assessed values
for
this year's revaluation. It includes Anson. Hello, listeners in Anson County. But not Mecklenburg County, because our revaluation is next year.
Okay. It just seems to me that we learned this lesson in Mecklenburg County. There was a long period, a longer than normal period, in which they didn't do these revaluations. And so when they did do them, it was sticker shock.
Right. But sometimes I wonder now whether that longer period was actually better for homeowners, because you're locking in that tax rate for a longer time and you have that sticker shock once every 8 years. Now, you know, it's every 4 years, and this next revaluation coming up, I think there is going to be some sticker shock because the office buildings have all declined in value, and that burden is going to shift to the homeowners.
But doesn't mean you have to raise taxes. You can revalue the property but keep the millage rate the same, and you can be revenue neutral.
Keep the tax rate the same, but some people will still end up paying more property taxes based on their assessed value.
Yeah, I think the thing is that just to – piggyback on what Joe said. For a long time in this city, we residents kind of got, I don't want to free ride, that's not the right word, but we got a good deal because Charlotte has so much high value commercial real estate. When you look uptown, all those big buildings, and a lot of them now, I don't want to say worthless, that's too strong, but their value has gone way, way down.
Yeah.
And so somebody has to, we have to pick up the slack.
Ashley, we just talked about this.
We did. I just wanted to add, when a commercial real estate property value goes down, it's so much more significant than a residential decline, because we're talking in the tens of millions in some cases. And that is a big slash cut. And a lot of the commercial property owners will contest their values to get them lower.
So how long would this pause in revaluation last?
It's just the 1 year.
Just one year.
For specific counties, yeah. But that's in connection with other property tax ideas that they have, like the levy limit in the House. Maybe they look at expanding some targeted relief programs.
So this was a Senate bill. It had bipartisan support. It passed 36-9 in the Senate. It will now have to go to the House and be debated there and rewritten. And then if it ultimately passes there, it would go to the governor. Is he likely to sign? Is it likely to pass the House?
I don't know about the governor. It surprised me just how bipartisan this vote was. So I don't really have a read on the politics around this bill. I guess in general, if you're a politician and, you know, property tax reductions, being against property tax increases is a popular position to take. Mm-hmm. But you also got to think about the impact to counties and, you know, whether they will be able to provide essential services or increase services for residents. So it's interesting to think about the politics surrounding this vote.
Meanwhile, in the House, House Speaker Destin Hall has already proposed a constitutional amendment to limit counties' ability to increase property taxes. He advocates placing a cap on that, and that has some county managers, including our own, a little concerned. A constitutional amendment, if it makes it through the legislature, would then be on the ballot in November for us voters to decide. Will voters simply see this as a protection against higher taxes? Or will they make the connection that if you cap taxes, there may be some things down the road that counties can't provide because they simply don't have the revenue?
I think the burden will be on counties to explain why limiting property tax increases is a bad thing. I think there's a great chance if it gets on the ballot, it passes. But we'll see if the legislature has the will to put this on the ballot, because they're the ones who are getting the pushback from their homes about the potential impacts of this.
And I believe that the Mecklenburg County Manager Mike Bryant has already spoken about that.
He has. And also the All-Republican Union County Board has come out against this as well. So it's a bipartisan thing.
We always talk about the Mecklenburg County Board of Commissioners. Let's spend a moment talking about the Wake County Board of Commissioners. They voted this week to press the pause button on a merger between Wake Med, their hospital system, and Atrium Health, ours. Don Mile is the chair of that body, and he says the delay is aimed at ensuring the two systems listen to the concerns of the community.
The board made this decision to provide time for the hospitals to engage with the community, so they, along with the county commission, can hear residents' comments and concerns about this combination.
This came just 96 hours after the potential merger became public and caused a litany of concerns to rise to the surface. Ashley, what were some of them?
Yeah, I think the deals like this get a lot of scrutiny because a lot of folks say, you know, this is just going to create higher costs for the patients. And, you know, obviously, whenever there's a merger deal, it gets scrutinized because it says there's less competition, less players. Obviously, who is going to benefit from that and who is going to lose out from that? And I think a lot of folks were just not pleased with how this process played out. It was basically just a line item on an agenda. And because the Wake County Board has to vote to change the articles of incorporation for Wake Med to allow the deal to go through. But it wasn't disclosed in any other form or way. And I think that irked a lot of people because this has potential to impact a lot of folks.
And one commissioner said that it appeared that when there was, quote, an attempt to avoid public scrutiny of this deal. This sounds vaguely familiar to me when it comes to governments in North Carolina. Was that an oversight or was it deliberate, do you think? Or do we know? Is there any way we'll ever know?
Well, probably not. But I do think it's interesting because it's a very big deal. Wake Med is the third largest hospital system in Wake County. Atrium Health has been on an M&A rush for the last several years. It obviously first joined Navescent Health in 2019, then Wake Forest Baptist in 2020, which made the med school here in Charlotte happened, and then in 2022, it combined with Advocate Health out of Wisconsin, I believe, and that makes it one of the largest hospital systems in the country.
So do officials in Wake County see any positives in this potential merger?
I think they just want to know more, and I think they want to hear more from their constituents. And yes, I mean, there's you could argue that there would be some potential benefits. You look at 3,000 jobs being created. You look at investment in the community. But I do think the research bears out that less competition just means higher costs for patients. And I think this has become such a big topic of discussion, not even just with this deal, but in general in healthcare.
Well, in their merger announcement, with Wake Med, Atrium said that Atrium intended to invest $2 billion. This is a hospital investing $2 billion over 10 years to create 3,300 jobs in Wake County. But the state treasurer, who has skin in the game here, because evidently the state health system uses Wake Med, the state treasurer, Republican Brad Briner, he's a Republican, sent a letter to the Wake County Board in which he wrote, quote, "I am not aware of any example where these types of transactions have resulted in patients being better off, and it is highly unlikely that this one will be the first." And he pointed to research that indicates hospital mergers like these can increase prices between 6 and 12%. Wow.
Yeah, and he also brought up the point that would Atrium make these investments anyway but for this deal? Would they see a competitive advantage clearly with this deal to be in Wake County and to grow its presence there? So I think he's just asking the question, why is this deal happening and who benefits? But I think it's notable that this has had bipartisan kind of scrutiny. Mm-hmm. Like you said, Briner is a Republican. Some Democratic lawmakers have also come out saying we just need to know more about the deal before we kind of sign off on it.
Plus, he's the state treasurer. So if prices are going to go up by 6 to 12% and the state funds their healthcare plan through Wake Med, that would affect taxpayers and the state.
Exactly.
Lawmakers are planning were planning to meet with officials from both hospitals on Tuesday of this week in order to better understand the deal. What, if anything, do we know about what they learned?
I think right now we're just in about a 90-day period. That was kind of what the Wake County Board had agreed to. We just need to take a 90-day pause to learn more. There was a press conference from both parties, Wake Med and Atrium, who basically were making the selling point about why this was a good thing and things of that nature. But again, I just think there's more we need to see transpire here.
We're taking a lot of 90-day pauses, pauses on tax revaluations, pauses on this, pauses on the I-77 transit plan. Is this normal? Is this how it works all the time? Or am I imagining that we're hitting the pause button a lot recently?
It does feel like more, but I don't know about historically.
I've stumped the panel.
Yes.
Okay. Duke Energy reportedly earned $1.58 billion in profit in the first quarter of this year. That's up $180 million from this time last year. And yet, they are seeking a rate hike to cover higher fuel costs incurred last fall, and they are courting new data centers to their service area. Harry Sedaris is Duke Energy's president.
We continue to seize the growth in our attractive regions, driven by innovation in AI technologies and advanced manufacturing.
So that's Sedaris speaking on a recent earnings call. But of course, there are indications that more data centers equal higher rates for residential customers. Is that likely to be the case if Duke is successful, Ashley?
Well, yeah, I think that's the concern here. I mean, clearly Duke spent a lot of their earnings this week talking about data centers. They have something like 7.6 gigawatts of data center projects in their pipeline. Just for kind of comparison, a 1 gigabyte could power about 500,000 homes. So that's a lot of power needs, a lot of power requirements. You know, I think this data center debate, and I'm sure we'll get to city council in just a second here, but it's become just such a contentious issue, because I think ratepayers are saying, I don't want to hold the bag for the development of these data centers, and because they take so much power and they take so much generation. What is going to be put in place to ensure that I'm not the one that's paying more because of this?
I'm on a move to the data centers, but as a ratepayer, I'm just curious if a company like Duke Energy makes $1.858 billion in profit in the first quarter. How does that compare to the extra cost they incurred last fall in fuel prices?
I don't actually know the answer to that. That's a good question. But, yeah, I don't know. I think they're just making the case that there was a lot of costs that they incurred, and this is something they have to deal with. But I don't actually know the answer to that.
And they can't take that off the bottom line. When we come back, we will talk about data centers and the fact that Charlotte City Council is a little concerned about data centers and the proliferation of those data centers. And the Transit Authority was supposed to swing into action soon. That may be put on hold, another pause button issue. And speaking of pausing, I-77. We'll talk about that when we come back. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. As part of the middle school Think Lab curriculum, students engage in hands-on, project-based learning focused on real-world problems. Information at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison, our politics reporter for WFAE News. Joe Bruno's here from WSOC-TV. Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte. And Ashley Fays, managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Data centers. During that earnings call that we just referenced a minute ago, Duke Energy President Harry Sedaris said that Duke has experienced 7.6 gigawatts of new demand for power across its territories, largely driven by data centers and by advanced manufacturing. But again, that increased demand has to be met by improving the grid and by adding energy generation capacity. So rates often rise when data centers come into the picture. And these data centers don't employ a lot of people, but they do improve, and they don't improve the tax base. So that led activist Sheila Sherrick, she's in Lee County, to ask officials there to pass a moratorium on data centers while posing an important question.
If everybody's rates are going up, where are the data centers contributing?
And speaking of moratoria on data centers, Charlotte appears to be debating that. Councilmember Dimple Ajmera wants one. Joe, you obtained a memo by City Attorney Andrea Leslie Fite to council members. What did that say?
Basically said that if Charlotte wants to do this, they need to lay out all of the reasons why a moratorium is appropriate. That was the big thing. And how a pause for however long the time period is, how that would improve conditions. So, and then there are some other process things that we all know about, like there has to be a public hearing, they have to, you know, provide advance notice. But those were the two main things that stood out to me.
So who's putting together this list?
So they have a presentation on Monday about data centers. And I think it will be a good level setting to find out just how many data centers already exist. How are they being built? Are they built by right? Are they approved through rezonings? How much water are they using? And what other projects are in the pipeline that could be potentially impacted by this? Because projects that already had their permits issued would not be impacted by the moratorium.
Although she, go ahead, Ash, Alex.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think it's pretty clear why they would want the moratorium. I don't know how much effort you have to put into spelling it out. They're allowed by right in a lot of zoning districts so that they can be built without city approval, without community input. And they're popping up really fast. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's like an out of line thing to say, why would we want to put this moratorium in place or what would be accomplished in that time?
Ashley.
And I think the timing is interesting because there is a rezoning petition in East Charlotte for a data center, and that's supposed to go before council on May 18th. So I think that's why the discussion is happening on May 11th. There will not be a public hearing, though, which I think is important to note because that is required for a moratorium to even be in the mix.
Well, among others, Dimple Ejmyra on the council would like a moratorium. She was on this program this week. She called it the wild, wild west when it comes to these data centers being permitted, et cetera. And there are no regulations, she says, governing these data centers in Charlotte. And that means that any data center that is permitted before there are regulations would be grandfathered in. They would not have to face the same regulations that new data centers would have to face. That's true?
Yeah. So, I mean, data centers have been around for a really long time. But I think what's really different about the ones being built today, these kind of hyperscalers, which is not what's being proposed in East Charlotte, but under the current zoning, you could build something like that in Charlotte that requires a lot of water and energy and such. But data centers have been allowed by right for a really long time. And I think the concern is that they're just going to get grandfathered in, even if they are these bigger projects.
Joe.
So there is that data center in the pipeline. I think it's 40,000 square feet. It is really close to some residential homes. So I understand the concern from neighbors there. But at the same time, just a couple of years ago, there was a vote 7-2 to approve 1.5 million square feet worth of data centers just up the street from here off of University City Drive. Right. And Councilmember Luana Slack Mayfield and Renee Johnson were really the only ones at that time trying to get the ball rolling on this. So in many ways, some of this conversation is happening, you know, too late because a huge data center is under construction right now as we speak. And the focus is on this small one, which, of course, is near residential homes.
So they're scheduled to hear, I think you said, Ashley, a presentation on this on Monday night. Who's giving the presentation at council?
I believe it's city staff. The city planning director said at a meeting a couple of weeks ago that her staff has been reviewing this, and they hope to have formal recommendations in 3 to 6 months. But this is going to be more of an informational presentation.
Okay. So the referendum on the 1 cent sales tax for transit that voters said yes to last November also created what is called, and I'll never be able to memorize this, the new Metropolitan Public Transportation Authority.
I always say Mecklenburg and authority gets confused. Yeah, MPTA.
And they were set to take over operational control of CATS and Lynx, et cetera, on July 1st. But it looks like that timeline will not be met. It came as no surprise to City Council's Malcolm Graham.
I think a number of us said back in October before the election that there was no way they were going to meet that deadline that was instructed in the payback. We said it was unrealistic from the start.
Why aren't they ready to take over on July 1st?
It is not easy to separate transit from the city of Charlotte into a new entity.
And they knew that.
They knew that. I mean, they had to put a date in the act. And I think that maybe, you know, this July date moved things up a little bit. Like, what if they just said, like, you have to do this within 2 years? Like, you know, they got the ball rolling.
So this means that the city maintains control until they're ready to take over? Is that what that means, essentially?
Yeah.
And do they have a new date?
I think their goal is October now.
Okay. Republican Councilman Ed Driggs says the most important thing is that the trains and buses continue to operate.
All I'm saying is we have a desire to make sure the service delivery continues. They're not ready to do it. It's not a perfect situation, and we're trying to figure out how it works.
That begs the obvious question. How it works? What are they trying to figure out? How this new commission works?
It's a messy divorce. I mean, the city employees have to, you know, they need to ensure that they'll have benefits still, that they'll keep their tenure, that this newly formed body of Congress, pretty much with 27 different members and like no staff
and no funding evidently.
And no funding, yeah. Like that they'll be able to handle the trains. Jeez. And I guess it like in a month, like it is unrealistic to think that they would be ready by July 1st.
But the city of Charlotte has said no employee jobs, benefits, or tenure will be lost to this transfer whenever it happens. So how are they making that assurance, given all the unknowns?
I think it is a promise and a guarantee, and they're working toward ironing out the nitty gritty details. They need to hire a CEO still. Like they don't have they don't have a permanent CEO. Brent Cagle's the longest interim ever, but it isn't his job. He has to apply for it.
Jeez. Okay. As the clock ticks down on the 90-day pause that the North Carolina Department of Transportation put on a decision on the I-77 toll lanes, pressure is mounting, and Alex, city staff at NCDOT pitched their case for the lanes to council on Monday night. And when they did, they were touting new bike lanes and sidewalks and streetlights. I find this very confusing because this is an interstate highway.
Yeah, they're definitely ramping up their defense. I think NCDOT is getting the vibe from city council members that they are going to take some kind of action soon, either to try to halt the project or stop it or just do something to their plans. But they came to city council this week and along with city staff and talked about how this would be a great opportunity to also, you know, while we're in there in 77, we'll also fix up the bridges. We'll give you guys new streetlights. We'll give you guys bike lanes, sidewalks, not exactly on the highway, but the bridges and the interchanges in those areas. And they also talked about adding some parkland around the West End, things like that. They also had a meeting on Wednesday with reporters where they kind of confronted us about how they're not agreeing with their reporting. They think that we are reporting on a loud minority and we should be focusing more on the commuters on 77 who would want this project. I disagree with that. I think that the opposition is very strong, stronger than a lot of other things I've ever reported on.
Really?
Yes.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. I report on a lot of things where you kind of hear this small minority and you report it and you say, you know, if this picks up traction, then you keep following the story. And this has snowballed. I'm into this big thing where look at city council. At first, it was kind of just Malcolm Graham talking about it. And now everybody wants to talk about it.
There are legitimate concerns surrounding this project, particularly when it comes to either widening the highway, which would cause great swaths of neighborhoods to be lost on the west side of Charlotte, or elevating the highway. And there are concerns about that because of site pollution and air pollution and noise pollution and some portions of property being taken for that. There's the side that wants the thing buried, which would be probably cost prohibitive. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about bike lanes.
Right.
Why aren't we talking about what has to happen? Because this has to happen.
You believe the highway needs to be widened.
Something has to happen. Have you been on it? Have you been on I-77 in your lifetime?
Definitely a side, but what they're doing with the bike lanes conversation is they're trying to really hype up the community benefits so they can get more people to agree to what you're saying.
So they're sugarcoating the pill?
I'm sorry, what was that?
They're sugarcoating the pill?
They're kind of just saying, here's what we can bring to the table. Here's what you'll get out of this. And if we don't widen the highway and build these toll lanes, you're probably not going to get it.
Meanwhile, Alex, you report that council members Victoria Watlington and Ed Driggs were scheduled to meet this week with UNC Charlotte researchers to discuss alternatives to the tolls. There are alternatives? What are they?
We do not know that yet. So Victoria Watlington says she's meeting with researchers at UNC Charlotte to study models. I don't know what that means. I think, but her point is we haven't done that. We haven't considered alternatives. So let's, I guess, go back to the drawing board and see what we can come up with. Are there other solutions to the tolls?
Steve?
Yeah, I think an interesting situation is what's happening in Gaston County. They're widening Interstate 85, which is, we all know that's also awful. It's a $1.5 billion project. They're adding just one lane. They are subject to the same quarter cap, the same funding limitations that we are. But they're able to widen 10 miles of the highway with no toll lanes. And what they did was they divided the project into three segments. And they applied and they tapped that state money three times.
Ah.
So that is an option. You know, in Charlotte, in theory, you could just do one free lane, no toll lanes on 77. You could chop up the project into different segments, apply for that money each time, just as Gaston County did. And, you know, and that's something that has never been talked about, because since 2007, the stated plan has been toll lanes on I-77, and there's been no deviation from that. And, you know, I think that'll be interesting to see whether that in this draft resolution, there was a little bit of talk about non-tolling options. The council made a vague reference to it, but they haven't really leaned in on that idea. And I think it's just interesting to look and see, like, how can Gaston access $1.5 billion of state money and we can't?
This draft resolution calls on NCDOT to halt, quote, irreversible work on I-77. And now that Mayor Vi Lyles has resigned and there will be a scramble to take her place, this is obviously already a political football. How will that all come together? Will the two intersect, the race for mayor and what happens with I-77?
Well, the mayor's resigning at the end of June,
right,
and the RFP is scheduled to go out in June. So in a way, the mayor is seeing this
request for proposal on what to do.
Right. Yes. And it remains to be seen just what this resolution actually does. Does it have teeth to say Ed Driggs has to go and tell the CARTPO, C-R-T-P-O, talk about acronyms, and say Charlotte is no longer in favor of this project at this time? I don't think the draft resolution says that. And, you know, it was a really lengthy resolution. The final copy of the resolution isn't posted on the agenda yet. So we'll see what the specific language is. But is this more of an expression of anger, an expression of like frustration, or is it an action that will actually cause meaningful pause in the project?
Yeah, that draft resolution had this line that said the city calls on the state to halt any procurement and as you said, Mike, irreversible actions. Okay, so what is procurement? A lot of council members I talked to, they had this idea in their head that halting procurement means we won't issue that RFP, which is, I think, a very reasonable assumption.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I asked Ed Driggs about that, and he says, no, no, procurement doesn't mean that. That means just signing the contract. So it's like he's kind of in his mind, he's like, oh, we can pass this and still issue the RFP and still keep the train going down the tracks. And so we'll see when this new resolution comes out if they've kind of cleaned up that ambiguity.
So let's end on a lighter note, shall we? You posed an interesting question this week, Joe. And the question was, whatever happened to Charlotte's 24-hour grocery store?
Did you ever partake in them?
Not past midnight.
No? Not even on the night shift?
No, that was they weren't here when I did that. When I did early mornings, they weren't. We didn't have any 24-hour grocery stores. Do we have any now? Are they gone?
They are gone. The grocery
Why?
Stores are
what
gone.
Happened?
You can go to the South Park Walgreens or the Belmont CVS or the Two Kings Mountain Casino.
I'm going to write down the Belmont CVS because that's where I'm going tonight.
There we go.
So.
Yeah, it was so. Yeah, my question was, whatever happened to 24-hour stores? And my second question was, what actually is open 24 hours? And grocery experts say that one of the main reasons that 24-hour stores have been phased out is just because of labor. It's more expensive to employ people. The amount of people who are shopping overnight doesn't necessarily justify keeping an extensive staff.
Right.
And so, you know, customer shopping habits have shifted. A lot more people use delivery now. And it made less sense for Harris Teeter and Walmart to keep their stores open 24/7.
And I have my hats off to you because you stayed up all night.
All night. To driving
cover the
it store, around.
Driving
it was
around
amazing.
Looking for stores. Jeez. The PGA's second largest tournament is in play at Quail Hollow. It got underway Thursday. It had a little rain delay. It plays through the weekend. It's the 2026 Truist Championship, the final event prior to the PGA Championship. That means a lot of high-profile golfers are here, right?
Correct. And Matt McCarthy is in the lead at this moment. You know, it was day one, and the mayoral race had my attention, or the mayoral announcement, but I'm looking forward to catching up to the Truist Championship drama.
And this has a $20 million purse, which says one thing. We all chose the wrong profession. Joe Bruno got the last word. WSOC-TV reporter Alexandria Sands here from Axios Charlotte. Ashley Fahey from the Charlotte Ledger. And WFAE's Steve Harrison, our politics reporter. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.